This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our Diabetes CDE Exam Boot Camp. This is our Class 5. And today we're going to be talking about really important information, and that's medication for type 2 diabetes. So we're going to be going over a lot of content today, and we're going to be going over the ADA algorithms, AACE algorithms, and also we're going to do some case studies and poll questions to really get us familiar with medications. For many of you, medications are a difficult content area, so please feel free to listen to this again, listen to the parts that give you the most trouble, and I would even encourage you to teach it to somebody. That seems to really help people. So I'm sure you have your medication pocket cards in front of you, your handout on the other side, and let's get started so we can get through this really important information. So what we're going to talk about today is the main action of the different categories of type 2 diabetes medications. We'll be looking at strategies to determine the right medication for the right patient, and we'll look at the side effects and clinical consideration for each category of medication. Now, this slide is a really good slide that I'm posting here because it comes from the CDE exam outline. So for all of the content I've been sharing with you, I've been really basing it on the CDE exam outline, and I got this piece from the guidebook where you take to apply for the CDE exam. They have a list of the objectives. I would really look through those, but I wanted to show you as far as medications. It's under assessment, medical health, psychologic, and economic status. They do talk about medication dose, prescription, non-prescription drugs, treatment fears, and then over here they say number 6, pharmacologic management, looking at the ADA and the ACE guidelines, medications, insulin, oral, injectables, delivery system, medication adjustments, interactions, and other non-prescription preparations. And again, here in the clinical practice guidelines, we need to be familiar with the standards of the ADA and the AACE, not only inpatient, but also outpatient. So let's just jump into a poll question because from your feedback, you said we love the poll questions, and I agree, they're a great learning tool, and they kind of help you get ready for that whole test-taking situation, which you'll be entering in soon. When starting patients on medication, what is the most important factor to consider? Is it A, their level of compliance, B, their diabetes pathology, C, their education level, or D, their preferences, needs, and values? I'm going to go ahead and launch this. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate you taking the time to vote. Okay, 90% of you voted, so we'll wait for one more person to vote. Yay, 100%. Great job. Okay. Share. So, when starting patients on medication, what is the most important factor to consider? So, on the exam, this is a very important question because this is called the underlying philosophy of the exam. And you'll notice a few words, most important. So, that is really critical. They're going to say most important in a variety of ways, like best, most important, strongest consideration, because they want you to strategize and do that, I don't know, fine-tuning and really getting down to the nitty-gritty of what is accurate. A, 10% of you chose this, the level of compliance. So whenever you see an answer with the word compliance, it's probably wrong. This exam is not based on compliance model, it's based on the empowerment model. And so that's called a juicy answer. Don't be lured in by juicy answers. This exam is not interested in level of compliance. It might say based on the patient's barriers or based on the patient's limitations. They might use those type of words, but it's an exam that looks at empowering patients and behavior change. So A is the wrong answer. B, diabetes pathology. So 20% of you chose that. It's another juicy answer. And when we think about medications, pathology is a consideration, but it's not our most important consideration because we might know the perfect drug for their pathology, but if the patient isn't willing to take it, it's not going to work. So that is the wrong answer. B, it's more of a medical answer, and again, this exam is for educators. So you want to put on your educator hat and really think, am I assessing the patient and what they're able to do? Nobody chose C, great job, but 70% of you did choose the right answer, their preferences, needs, and values. So that's really important. Whenever you're looking at answers to a question, you want to look, is it using old school thought where you do tell a patient what to do and they have to follow, or is it looking at empowerment? And D certainly is empowerment model. And let me just show you in an upcoming slide the ADA guidelines. Let me just see where that is. Here it is. Patient-centered approach. So this comes right from the ADA guidelines for medication, the 2012 and the 2015. It says providing care that is respectful and responsive to individual patients' preferences, needs, and values. This was in the medication paper for starting people type 2 on medications. This was their opening paragraphs. Ensuring that patient values guide all clinical decisions. We want to gauge a patient's preferred level of involvement, explore therapeutic choices. So we may present to the patient, here's your options, which one do you think is going to match you best? Utilize decision aids and look at this, shared decision-making. The final decisions regarding lifestyle choices ultimately lie with the patient. So important. We can know the best reasons for patients to take a medication, but if they're not willing to take it, it ain't going to happen. And so we need to really engage them. I'm going to go back one slide. Diabetes medications can be used by themselves or in combination with other medications or with insulin. Different classes have an additive effect. Most reduce A1C about 0.5 to 2%, which means if you drop A1C 2%, you've dropped blood sugar 60 points. And it says here, not to be used during preconception, pregnancy, or breastfeeding. All medications, except for insulin, are off-label during preconception, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. They're off-label, which means the FDA did not grant them approval during those stages of life. But I do want to say those medications are used in different clinical settings for patients. But the ADA still does not fully endorse them. They say they may be used, but I just want you to know they're off-label, which means they're not FDA approved for that use. So let's keep going. So you just want to focus on what the guidelines talk about. Approach to the management of hyperglycemia. This is from the ADA Standards of Care 2015. We want to be familiar with this. So the A1C, we want to push it less than 7. We have to be more stringent to achieve that goal. If we let the A1C float up between 7 and 8, we can be less stringent. And so depending on your target A1C and the patient's ability, we're going to have different strategies here. So look at it says, risk potentially associated with hypoglycemia and other adverse drug effects. If the risk is low, we can be more stringent. But if they have a high risk, we're not going to be as aggressive on their medication. If they're newly diagnosed, we're going to be really much more stringent. We know that from the legacy report that catching diabetes early on and treating it aggressively protects beta cells. But if they have diabetes for a long time, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, we may be a little bit less stringent. We know we can let the A1C float up a little bit higher. Life expectancy, same thing. A long life, we're going to be more stringent. Shorter life expectancy, we might be a little more relaxed. Vascular complications, if they're absent, we can really be aggressive. But if they have more vascular complications, we have to be conservative in our approach because of the risk for polypharmacy and hypoglycemia. Really so important. Patient attitude and expected treatment efforts. If they're really motivated, adherent, see that means the word compliant, adherent, excellent self-care capabilities, we're going to be really stringent. But if they're less motivated, you know, poor ability to take care of themselves, we're going to have to relax a little bit. But look at this. These top ones, they usually not modifiable, but this is modifiable. So if we get the patient resources and assistance and help and counseling, they may actually become more motivated and more, they'll have more available social support so we can be more stringent. So when we consider medications for people with diabetes, we're going to consider a lot of different factors. Cost. So when I think about cost, I think about what insurance coverage do they have? That's really important. If they're cash pay, I'm really going to be very conservative on what medications I recommend for them. If they have great insurance, I have a wider field to choose from. Are they at risk for a hypo? What's their age? What's their body weight? And what are their comorbidities? So we'll be going over these in more detail as we go through the slides. But I just want to put out there, it's not just the pathology or it's not just patient attitudes. We have to consider this whole picture is going to come into play when figuring out the right medication for our patients. When goal is to minimize costs, we want to go generic. And I have again here information on cheapest medications. Metformin and sulfonylureas. Walmart offers a 3-month supply of the following medications. That's metformin and metformin XR, glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride for $10. Wow, so cheap. So this may be, it may be less expensive for patients to pay cash pay for these medications and even pay their copay. So Walmart, again, has really stepped up to the plate to help people with diabetes afford the treatment plan. Other generics include Actos, Avandia, Acarbose. But these can still cost up to $100 a month if you're cash pay. So we have to always look at the different factors. I did write an article, Medications on a Budget, you can take a look at, because I work with so many patients who are struggling with cost. Let's take a look at poll question number 2. According to the ACE glycemic control algorithm, so ACE is American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, according to the ACE algorithm, what is the first step to control hyperglycemia in type 2? Is it A, lifestyle modification, B, start insulin, C, start metformin, or D, start type 2 meds if their A1C is 7.4 or greater? What is the first step? Let me go ahead and launch the poll and see what we come up with. So you may be wondering, do I need to be familiar with the ACE guidelines and the AADE guidelines? Yeah, you do. For the exam. And with the ACE guidelines, they do have a nice slide summary set that really highlights key points. Then I have a link to that on your resource page. I just put that down in there this morning. Well, let me clarify. The ACE guidelines have always been on your resource page. They're at the very top. But I added the 2015 this morning. Okay, so let me close this because most of you have voted. And let me share. So 85% of you said start lifestyle modification. And that is the right answer. So good job. If you chose this, that's really excellent because the ACE and the ADA both say anybody newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, we start with lifestyle modification. That's the number one thing that appears on both of their charts. Some of you said start metformin. That is true, but it's the next step. So we always say exercise, lose weight, start metformin. So the first step to control hyperglycemia is lifestyle in both ACE and ADA. Okay. So, oh, here it is. Anti-hyperglycemic therapy, first step, losing weight. Eating healthy, activity. And with weight control, both ADA and AACE do recommend that gastric bypass for morbidly obese patients with diabetes and comorbidity can be a consideration. So then after we go through medication lifestyle, if that is not succeeding, we have to add a medication on top of that. So the ADA says, you know, if their A1C isn't too high, around 7, and they can't get their blood sugars to goal through lifestyle, let's start them on medication. And for both ACA and ADA, their first choice is the biguanide metformin. So I'm just going to spend a few minutes on this, and if you have your medication pocket card, if you could pull that out. So there's seven different classes of medications for type 2. It's so many different kind of medications. I'm going to just provide you with the framework, and then we're going to drill down and talk about each of these. So don't feel overwhelmed right now. It's going to be a lot of information, but we're going to break it up and talk about each of these. The suppressor, you know that, the biguanide, metformin. The squirter, what does that mean? These are words I made up myself. They tell the pancreas to squirt insulin. That's the sulfonylureas and meglitinides. And so for the exam, you do need to understand the classes of medication. This class does what? So you need to know, and then what medications go with what class. So you need to know the classes, which I have here on the right, and their main action is important too. And then what medications fall under these classes. Number three, we have the satiator. So the satiators, you want to pull out your green card on the back. It has injectables that lower glucose. We have the incretin mimetics or the GLP-1 agonists. And we also have the amylin mimetics. We'll talk about more. And on your blue card, we have the DPP-4, like the Januvias. We have medications that make you more sensitive to insulin. Those are the thiazolidinediones, Actos and Avandia. If you look at your purple card, you'll see those on the back. And these make your muscles more sensitive to your body's own insulin. We have a new class of medication, or the newest class, the glucuretic. What does that mean, glucuretic? They help you urinate out sugar. So like diuretic, they're glucuretics. And if you look at the back of your purple card, you'll see they're known as the SGLT2 inhibitors, and there's three of them, Invokana, Farxiga, and Jardiance. We have number six, the circadian switcher. It's on the back of your card, known as a dopamine receptor agonist. We hardly see that used. I haven't really heard of it coming up on the exam, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But it is called Cyclocet, and it increases your dopamine levels, which can help reduce blood sugars. And then we have the slowers on the back of your purple card again, the alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, and they actually do slow the absorption of carbohydrate in your intestine. So we'll talk about those briefly too. So that's just kind of our main classes, and then we're going to drill down and talk about most of those. So the ADA stepwise approach to hyperglycemia, this is their 2015 guideline. A, start with lifestyle coaching. We've gone over that. B, when lifestyle alone is not achieving A1C goal, metformin should be added at or soon after diagnosis, unless contraindicated. What would be contraindication? Yeah, kidney problems. Look at this. Metformin has a long-standing evidence base for efficacy. It's cheap, safe, and may reduce cardiovascular risk. If A1C target is not achieved after 3 months, consider adding one of six treatment options or basal insulin. So we're going to go over those. For all patients, this is ADA still, for all patients, consider starting dual therapy or insulin if A1C is above 9%. So anybody with an A1C 9% or greater is glucose toxic. They usually won't just respond to oral meds. They're going to need oral meds plus insulin, most likely, or at least dual therapy, two pills. So glucose toxicity, A1C above 9, we have to be a little bit more aggressive. If we do all that stuff and A1C is still above target, consider basal bolus therapy. We talked about that last time, so that'd be bolus insulin plus basal, or add a GLP-1 agonist. Interesting. We'll talk about those. Or consider twice daily premixed biphasic insulin, which we've already discussed. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on this because it's really important. This comes from the ADA Standards of Care 2015, and then I'm going to compare it to the ACE. So let's just spend a few minutes looking at this. I would encourage you to go back and look at it more closely on your own. Actually, you could make this really nice flashcard. You could cut out each of these little boxes and answer the question for yourself. I'm going to go over this. Like for example, let me just take 1 minute and I'll come back to that. I want to point out one thing. Healthy eating, weight control, increased physical activity, and diabetes education, numero uno, first thing we start with. If the A1C is still above target, we're going to start metformin. And so these represent something important. It says high here. What are they talking about? Efficacy. So that's what I was saying for the flashcards. You could cut this out and say to yourself, how efficacious is sulfonylureas? What's the risk of hypoglycemia? What's the weight gain risk? What's the side effect? What are the costs? And so that would be a really nice little self-quiz for you. But anyways, metformin, high efficacy, and that means it's going to drop the A1C 1 to 2 percentage point. Hypoglycemia risk, it's really low with metformin. People don't get hypo on it. It's very rare. What about weight? Neutral. People either don't gain any weight or they lose weight. What are the major side effects? GI, bloating, nausea, diarrhea, and lactic acidosis if their creatinine or their kidneys aren't working right. And the cost is low. So this is a really nice summary of the medications. So metformin, you could see that it's very desirable for all those reasons. And then if the blood sugar is still not achieved within 3 months of monotherapy, proceed to two-drug combination. And this is important. It says order not meant to denote any specific preference. Choice depends on a variety of patient and disease-specific factors. Huh. So we could say metformin plus sulfonylurea. And if you look at sulfonylurea, as you can see, very efficacious, moderate risk of hypoglycemia. Patients do gain weight on it. Side effect, hypo, and cheap. What about our thiazolidinediones? That's Actos and Avandia. You can see the efficacy is high, low risk of hypo. They do gain weight from fluid. Major side effects, edema. HF is heart failure, and that means fractures. Cost is low. So you can go through all of these, and I think this is a real nice template or tool to use when we're thinking about which medication matches our patient. For example, if they're really at high risk for hypoglycemia, I want to choose one of the ones that has a low risk for hypoglycemia, like the DPP-4s. That's Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta. It has an intermediate efficacy, low risk of hypo, weight neutral, side effects rare, cost high. I'm going to keep going. SGLT2 inhibitor, that's the Invokana, Tradjenta, Nucina. I'm sorry. Go back on that one. Go back. Rewind that. SGLT2 inhibitors. As soon as it came out, I'm like, that's not right. Invokana, Farxiga, and Jardiance. Those are the three in that class right now. But look at this. Efficacy, intermediate, hypoglycemia, low risk, weight. They usually lose weight on this. What are the side effects? GU means genitourinary infections, dehydration, cost high. Now, if we look at the GLP-1 agonist that's on your green card, those are the Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza, Tanzium, and Trulicity. Look at their efficacy high, low risk of hypo, people lose weight on it, side effects GI in nature, some nausea, and then cost high. And then we have insulin. Look at insulin, highest efficacy, high risk of hypo, weight gain, and the main side effect hypoglycemia. So this is a real nice algorithm to take a look at. But look at this, if A1C not achieved after 3 months of dual therapy, proceed to three drug combination. So then we go to here, now we have metformin plus sulfonylurea plus one of these. Then down here, if target not achieved and they're on triple therapy, an oral combination, move to injectables. So you can go to but you keep the metformin. So you go metformin plus basal insulin, and then you might have to add mealtime insulin or the GLP-1. That's this algorithm. I would be familiar with it. Now, just to kind of give you some more information, if your brain isn't full right now, I'm going to give you some more information, so my apologies. This is the AACE, American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. Look what number one is, lifestyle modification, including medically assisted weight loss. This is a different type of algorithm. It doesn't say just start everybody with metformin and add on as it matches the patient. They actually give us more specific guidelines. They say if the A1C is less than 7.5, start monotherapy. And they do rank these medications from their most preferred to their least preferred. This gives us different information. So you can see here metformin is the most preferred, and you go down to sulfonylureas, glycerides, lower preference because of the risk of hypoglycemia and weight gain. Okay, so they have a different way of looking at it. If the A1C is less than 7.5, start metformin. If they can't tolerate it, our next choice would be the GLP-1s, which is the Byetta, Bydureon, etc. If that doesn't work, we go to the DPP-4s. Sorry, sometimes my mouse forwards my slides. And then this is the alpha-glucosidase inhibitor, the fourth one. And then they say if the A1C is more than 6.5 in 3 months, add second medication, dual therapy. Keep the metformin, add a second one. And again, they've ranked them by preference. Or if the entry A1C is more than 7.5, we go right to dual therapy. Now they say something over here. If the entry A1C is greater than 9 and there's no symptoms, dual therapy or do triple therapy. But if they're symptomatic, start insulin plus other agents. So each of these algorithms gives us a different perspective. But both of them say when that A1C is greater than 9, we have to do more than, you know, we need to usually do 2 or more medications or use insulin for most patients if that A1C is in the 9 category. So you can take a look at this. This gives you different information to help figure out what medication is the best match for your patients. And in my level 2 courses, I do have medications management class. Oh, it might be in my level 3. I'll have to double check. But it's not just medications, it's medication management. So it really goes over using these algorithms in much more detail. But for right now, let's just keep going and now break down the medications. I needed to give you a framework, and from that framework now we can look at each of the medications. So just kind of review that on your own to get, you know, to get more familiar with it. But if we were to design our ideal diabetes medication, what would it look like? Well, there would be no hypoglycemia, no weight gain. It would be cheap for everybody. It will lower cardiovascular risk, and most people could use it. So that's kind of our ideal med, the one that we would most, the qualities we would like to have. Do all the medications meet this criteria? Probably not, but let's break it down and see which ones do. But before we do, let's go to a poll question. John has started on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day. Which of the following is true? A, hold metformin if your blood glucose is less than 90. B, if you forget to take metformin before the next meal, before the meal, hold the dose. Is it C, take metformin with meals, or is it D, always hold metformin if you are sick? So let's launch this poll and see what you all come up with. Thanks for voting, everyone. Okay, I'll take one more second. And I'm going to close this. Thank you so much. So, let me just share this with all of you. John is on metformin 500 twice a day. What is true? So you all, nobody chose A, that's great. Nobody chose B, great. 93% of you chose C, so it's looking like it's the right answer. Is it? Yes, it is, because it's the true answer. In that you take metformin with meals. Some of you chose D, and I did put that in purposefully as a juicy answer. And it says here, always hold metformin if you are sick. So anytime you see the answer with the word always in it, steer away, because always is usually an indicator that it's not going to hold true for every patient out there. So let me just give you an example. What if John is 24 years old and he's got a little bit of a fever and his kidneys are working great and he can drink water and he's, you know, he maybe even goes to work. He could definitely still take his metformin. So holding metformin when you are sick is based on individual situation. Not everyone holds their metformin when they are sick. And I didn't say, you know, he's vomiting and he's got diarrhea and he's severely dehydrated. That would be a different story. I just said, you know, he's sick. So The right answer is C, take metformin with meals. And most of you got that right, so great job. Oh, Sally wants to know, why is it important to take metformin with meals? It causes less GI distress. So taking with meals is a good way to feel less nausea and bloating, and you're more likely to remember it. Yeah, it's so hard to remember. Patients with diabetes are on a lot of medications. So trying to remember to take your medication, man, it's all your medications is hard. But metformin, the action of metformin is to suppress the release of glycogen from the liver. So who is this medication great for? Anybody with fasting hyperglycemia. So that describes most of our type 2s. They tend to have high morning fastings because they're insulin resistant, and overnight their livers pump out a lot of sugar. Anybody with dysmetabolic syndrome, what does that mean? Well, you know, the hypertension, hyperlipidemia, hyperglycemia, those at risk for cardiovascular disease. It is the only FDA-approved oral medication for kids starting at the age of 10. We have an extended release that is approved starting at the age of 17. So I call metformin the glycogen stopper, which means it stops the liver from breaking down its glycogen stores. It also is a GLP enhancer, maybe. That's not on the exam, but I was reading a really great article by Dr. DeFranzo and friends, and they were talking about that it seems to enhance the levels of our gut hormone or our GLPs. So it might have some additional benefits we haven't even figured out yet. So biguanides decrease hepatic glucose release or the glycogen release. We have metformin regular version. You can take it 500 milligrams twice a day with a max dose of 2,500 milligrams. But there is an extended release, and I actually like the extended release better. I think I've talked about this before, because you just have to take it once a day at dinner time. It lasts for 24 hours. It is a large pill, so just to let patients know, it is kind of big as a pill, but it's easy to do once a day, and you get the same outcomes, and it's not any more expensive. Look at this, it decreases fasting plasma glucose up to 70 points, and it drops A1C 1 to 2%. So very effective. Here are some of the benefits. It decreases LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, no weight gain, possible weight loss. Maybe it's cancer protective. There's some studies coming out that, you know, people with diabetes have a higher risk of cancers, breast, liver, pancreatic cancer, and maybe this kind of helps mitigate that a little bit. The biggest concerns are diarrhea and abdominal discomfort. So for those patients, we definitely want to use XR, but why not use extended release for all patients? Lactic acidosis, if improperly prescribed, so we know that their kidneys have to be working well to take this medication. This medication won't harm your kidneys in any way. You just have to have good functioning kidneys to release the metabolites and, you know, of the drug to prevent lactic acidosis. Some patients might have B12 deficiency on metformin, so if they're having any signs of nerve pain, we want to just make sure they have a B12 replacement on board. We don't typically test for B12, we just base it on symptoms. We want to hold metformin prior to IV contrast dye studies and use caution during acute illness, resume when kidney function is adequate. So here's the contraindications due to risk of lactic acidosis. Creatinine is the major marker of kidney health, but the American Diabetes Association 2015 said maybe we should be doing like Europe does and use GFR as our measure of safety. And it says here if the GFR is less than 45, the max dose is 1,000 milligrams a day. If GFR less than 30, stop metformin. So now on my patients, I'm looking at creatinine, but I'm also looking at GFR to get some more information, because we don't want to stop this medication if it's working for a patient just based on their creatinine alone. We want to consider now that GFR too. So how would we rank metformin? So for each of the medications, we're going to do this ranking exercise, and I do it so that we can really get a better handle on these medications. It's just a different strategy to help you learn them. So this is another strategy to help these medications be cemented in your brain for the exam, but also for your clinical practice too, of course, which is the most important thing. Does metformin cause hypoglycemia? No, it doesn't. Does it cause weight gain? Nope. Is it affordable? Oh yeah. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? It does. It's one of the few medications that can say we lower cardiovascular risk. Can most people tolerate? Yeah, most people can. Some people get GI problems. So what would you give this medication out of five? If we're like Siskel and Ebert, what would you say you would, how many stars would you give this medication out of five? Five being the best medication ever. Well, I'm going to give it a five today because I'm just really appreciating this med. No hypoglycemia, no weight gain. You can afford it. It lowers your heart risk, and most people can tolerate it. I don't know. It doesn't get much better than that when it comes to diabetes medications. So I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5 stars. You might have your own perceptions of it, but I think it warrants that. It's been around for over 40 years, so a tremendous safety profile too. Okay, let's do another poll question. Mary has newly diagnosed type 2 and is concerned about taking glipizide or Glucotrol. So on the exam, they will list the generic and the trade names. Which of the following teaching points is most important for patients taking sulfonylureas? A. Most patients experience some weight loss. B. 50% of patients have no improvement in blood glucose. D. Do not take with grapefruit juice. C. Know the signs of hypoglycemia. What's true? Which of the following teaching point is most important for patients on sulfonylureas? Okay, you guys are seriously showing off right now. You're just like, nobody's even, because I can see when you click what answers you click on, nobody's even clicking on any of my juicy answers. You're just like, oh no, we know this one. Good job. Good job, Team Boot Camp. I'm going to close this and share with all of you. So you all just nailed it on the nail on the head. Know the signs of hypoglycemia. So I had some juicy answers in there. You guys didn't even consider those. So sulfonylureas we're probably really familiar with because they've been around forever. And they tell the pancreas to squirt insulin all day long. And so for that reason, I kind of have this funny thing. Who are these medications good for? And I say lean type 2s because since they're telling the pancreas to squirt insulin all day long, patients tend to gain weight on this because well, they don't really know why. Maybe some of it's fluid. But suppose you take your Glucotrol before you eat breakfast, and then lunch is rolling around, and you want to eat a light lunch. But because you have that Glucotrol or glipizide or glyburide on board, all sulfonylureas, your blood sugar is getting low. And so you're compelled to eat. And so this tells your pancreas to squirt out insulin all day long. So skipping meals or, eating really low carb is hard to accomplish. And so we just see patients put on, I don't know, about 5 pounds, 5 to more. But I do want to say something about weight gain. Anytime you have a blood sugar of 300 and you bring it down to, let's say, 150, you're going to gain weight. Because when your blood sugar was 300, you were spilling out all your sugar from your urine. And now when your blood sugar is 150, you're holding on to that energy. And so it does really, people experience weight gain when their blood sugars go from elevated to normalized. And so I tell patients, be ready for that because that's a sign of your body healing and recovering. When you're gaining weight, it's because now you're holding onto the fuel you were once letting go in your urine. Sulfonylureas increase endogenous insulin secretion. As I've mentioned, here's another thing. A lot of people ask me, well, Bev, do they burn out your pancreas? No, they don't burn out your pancreas. So just because your pancreas is squirting out more insulin doesn't mean that you're going to run out of juice. What burns out the pancreas is glucose toxicity when your blood sugars are chronically in the 300s. That's what's really hard on the pancreas. These medications are very effective. They lower fasting blood sugar 60 to 70 points. This is just like metformin. Reduce A1C by 1 to 2 percentage points. There is a secondary failure, which means about 5 to 10% of people don't respond to it that well. But after about 5 years or more of diabetes, you still have what they call secondary failure, where patients don't really respond to it that well anymore. That's just the natural history of diabetes. So for most people, after 5 years of being on one medication, We usually need to add another medication. We don't stop and switch. We usually add on to potentiate both of those medications to do their best job. So if you think about the algorithms, they don't ever say stop and change. They always say, if they're on metformin, add the next medication, two meds, and then add three meds, because we know they have a synergistic effect when used in combination. Here's a second generation sulfonylureas. So I just have a little note here. This came from the ADA algorithm. Gliburide, also known as diabeta or micronase, most likely to cause hypoglycemia, last choice. Kind of the two darlings are here. The glipizide, if I have anybody with renal failure, I use just regular plain old glucotrol. These drugs are cleared by the kidneys, so I would not use an extended release for anybody with kidney problems. I would use just a straight old glucotrol, which has a little bit shorter half-life. Glimepiride is Amaryl. It's a micronized sulfonylurea, so it releases a little bit over 24 hours. And so, you know, these medications, I choose glucotrol. And if they have cardiovascular disease, Amaryl seems to be the safest for those with heart disease. The sulfonylureas are involved with this thing called cardiac remodeling, and they might be causing some problems with the heart. So that's not anything you'll see on the exam, but just for your own clinical practice, if the patient already has cardiovascular disease, Amaryl seems to be the safest, and that comes from the ADA guidelines. Sulfonylureas, other effects, hypoglycemia, weight gain, cleared by kidneys, so we need to be cautious, and generally the least expensive class of medication. So that's good to know. These are all the benefits and problems with these medications. I do want to talk about another secretagogue called the meglitinides. These are what I would call a fast-acting insulin secretagogue. So secretagogue, just saying it tells the pancreas to squirt out insulin. We don't see these used much, but they might appear on the exam, so I want to go over them with you. They tell the pancreas, so remember how the sulfonylureas tell the pancreas to squirt out insulin with meals? The sulfonylureas tell the pancreas to squirt insulin throughout the day. These just tell the pancreas to squirt insulin with meals. Totally different. So you have to take this medication before you eat, and when you take it, it tells the pancreas at that moment to squirt insulin. It's the closest thing we have to oral insulin. Really, it is. It targets postprandial hyperglycemia. And so I call it the rabbit. So you can see I have a rabbit because it hops in, it does its job, and it hops back out. So it tells the pancreas to squirt with meals, but you have to take it with every meal. So that's the problem. You have to remember to take it. And it says it stimulates insulin secretion when glucose is present. So it does seem to kind of sense if the blood sugars are low or high, and it won't stimulate the pancreas to squirt if the blood sugars are on the lower side. We have prandin, also known as repaglinide. It's metabolized by the liver and mostly excreted in the feces. So the reason I have this on there is because prandin is a real safe medication, sulfonylurea, for people with kidney disease, because it's not cleared by the kidney, it's cleared by the liver. So it won't hang around for an extra length of time. So prandin for people on dialysis or with kidney problems is a real safe choice as long as they have good liver function. Starlix is the other meglitinide we have. It's metabolized by the liver, excreted by the kidneys. So still need to consider kidney function with that one. But you can see these are very efficacious. They lower blood sugars 60 to 70 points, A1C 1 to 2 percentage points. But you do have to take them with every meal. And I want to say one other thing. Since they do stimulate the release of insulin from the pancreas, they can cause low blood sugar and weight gain, but less. They cause less low blood sugar and less weight gain than the sulfonylureas. So they're a little bit better, but we don't use them that much. You have to take them with every meal, and a lot of insurance companies won't cover them. So I'm going to put the meglitinides and the sulfonylureas together here. Squirters, how do they rate? Do they cause hypoglycemia? Yes, they do. Do they cause weight gain? Yep, They cause weight gain. The magliclinides cause less weight gain than the sulfonylureas. Are they affordable? Well, the sulfonylureas are really affordable, like the glipizide, amaryl, glyburide. The magliclinides are not that affordable. They're still more expensive. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No. There's no studies that show that they improve heart outcomes or cardiovascular outcomes. Can most people tolerate? And I put a yes, no. And that's my way of saying, well, yeah, most people can, but the problem is it can cause hypoglycemia. So, and weight gain. So would you all give this out of five? What the squirters, what would you rate it out of five? I'm going to give them a three. I'm going to give them a three. I love that they're inexpensive. I love that they're easy to take. But these two issues, hypoglycemia and weight gain, are such big issues for our patients, especially elderly or people who are struggling with their weight, that makes them really challenging to utilize effectively. I mean, if I have patients who are cash pay and their blood sugars are elevated, these are really great for that reason. But if they can't afford it, I might choose a different medication because of those side effects. Let's do another question. We have a 72-year-old. She's thin. She lives alone. Her A1C is 7.3. She has a history of stroke and MI. Diabetes for 12 years, diet controlled, she says, that's in quotes, and her A1C and her creatinine is 1.4. So if she has limited income, which medication might you consider for her, given this situation? Well, before I even go to that, I want to ask you another question. Her A1C is 7.3. Does she really need medication? You know, she's 72 years old. She's maybe her life expectancy isn't that great. She's had a history of heart attack and stroke, diabetes for a long time. Maybe the A1C at 7.3 is okay. And I would say that's true. We have to evaluate every patient differently. But maybe for her, you know what? That's okay for her to be there. And so we need to just base it on the patient needs, values, and preferences and find out. But maybe she's the kind of gal who says to you, you know what? I've always had an A1C less than 7. I can't stand this. This blood sugar is way too high for me. So if she says that to me, just like that chart showed us, I'm going to take action with, you know, and help her achieve that. And of course, we'll make sure the dietitian reevaluates her and make sure she's getting enough calories and so forth. But if she has limited income, what medication do you think would be a good match for her? Well, I want to say it's not the metformin, because metformin doesn't work as well on older, thin patients. And metformin, since she's already thin, might actually cause her to lose a little bit of weight. So that's not the right choice for her. I'm already worried about her appetite, given her body weight. But those sulfonylureas that we just talked about might be a really good choice for her. Even the magliclinides, the ones where you take it when you eat, so she's not eating that much, she would just take that medication when she eats. But that could still be expensive. So let's go back to sulfonylureas. I would really consider a low-dose glucotrol for her. So glucotrol is the safest of the sulfonylureas, and she could take it once a day, very low dose, and it might actually help her gain some weight and give her more permission to eat. I meet a lot of patients who are doing what I call carb deprivation. They're not eating enough carbs because they're worried that it will crank up their blood sugar, and she might be doing that. And so if she goes on the glucotrol, she could eat a little bit more carbohydrates and not worry about her blood sugars becoming elevated. So that would be one choice if she's a limited income. I know her creatinine is a little bit elevated, so I'm going to make sure that she has a glucose meter and she knows the signs of hypoglycemia. And if her, you know, make sure she communicates with her provider and educator if she's getting any signs to adjust her medication dose. But what about this? What if she has good insurance? What medication would you consider? Well, if she has good insurance, we might consider the medication class known as the DPP-4 inhibitors, which we'll get to in a minute, because they would help lower her blood sugars in a safer way. But before we go on to that, let's do a poll question. Fred is ready to take medications to get his blood sugars to target, yet he is very concerned about avoiding hypoglycemia since his brother almost died from a hypoglycemic incident. What medication class would you recommend? A, magliclinides, B, SGLT2 inhibitors, C, sulfonylureas, Or D, analog insulins? Okay, I'm going to launch the poll. And so on the exam, they're going to have questions like this with a lot of extra information that you have to figure out. What does this information have to do with the question? So they're just trying to, put these questions in the context of a person living with diabetes and evaluate your ability to pull out the relevant points and get to the right answer. Okay, 60% of you have voted, so you guys are thinking hard. I can almost hear you thinking. Maybe you're looking at your medication pocket cards. Great. That's awesome. Einstein said, "Why memorize it if you have the resources?" Well, Einstein wasn't taking the CDE exam. So for the CDE exam, you do have to do some memorization. But after the exam, you can, use those tools when you're working with patients, of course. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll since most of you have voted. Thank you, everybody. Okay, so here's the deal. He's really concerned about avoiding hypoglycemia because his brother almost died from a hypoglycemic event. What medication class would you recommend? So as I mentioned earlier, you need to know the main considerations, the different classes of medications. So again, this, you want to choose the best answer. That's another really important point. So we know that the meglitinides can cause hypoglycemia. 6% of you chose that. That's okay because I did say that they cause less hypoglycemia than sulfonylureas, but they still have the risk of hypoglycemia. So A is not the right answer. The best answer here is B, SGLT2 inhibitors. We're going to be going over those. Those are the glucuretics that help to tell the kidneys to release sugar. But they're going to ask questions like this on the exam, so you need to be familiar with the class of medication, and what their main action is. Okay, great job, everybody. Older adults considerations. So now we're just thinking about that gal in the case study. She's older, she lives alone. We're going to look at their life expectancy, their risk of heart disease, look at their kidney function. People who are older are at big risk for adverse events from polypharmacy. So really encouraging my patients to meet with their pharmacists, talk to their pharmacists, see if we can't simplify regimens is so important. And more likely to be compromised from hypoglycemia. It can be really dangerous. So for our older patients, we might set a little bit higher A1C target. But like our gal said, I want to get my A1C down. She's ready for action. So let's see what we're going to do. When the goal is to avoid hypoglycemia, avoid sulfonylureas and meglitinides, we could add. Careful insulin dosing may need to up-adjust glucose goals. So instead of saying, oh, your blood sugar goal is 80 to 130, we may say 100 to 130. Watch the kidneys and reinforce for patients to tie. Test, inject, eat. Or test, give your medication, and eat would be another way of looking at that. Because we want to make sure our patients always associate, taking their medications with meals. Just in general, that's an important target. Even if those medications don't cause hypoglycemia, it's just a good routine to get into. Let's talk about DPP-4 inhibitors. We said for that gal, she wants to get her blood sugars down. She has good insurance. What would be a choice that we could recommend on her behalf? And the DPP-4 inhibitors are also known as the incretin enhancers. So they help our gut hormones work better. Whenever you see this word incretin, it means gut hormones. That's what it means. It's the scientific word that they made up to summarize gut hormones. So this medication does, increase the level of gut hormone in your intestines. Increases level of gut hormone. They're known as Januvia, Tradjenta, Onglyza, Nucina. So those are on your purple card on the front. So they increase insulin release with meals and suppress glucagon. Really important. And that can help result in lowering of the blood sugars. They're once a day dosing, and look how much they lower A1C, 0.6 to 0.8. So as the ADA algorithm said, they have an intermediate efficacy. They're not hot shots, but they do their job. And if that our patients are running 7.3 or 7.4, this is a great medication to get them back under 7. It's usually not a first-line medication. Maybe for elderly patients, we want to go really easy and they're lean. It might be a first line, but usually it's a second or third line medication for type 2s. So, Januvia and Onglyza are eliminated via the kidneys, so lower dose needed. If you're going to be a patient is on those medications and they have kidney failure, we might have to give them a lower dose. And you can look at the package insert for that. But if you look at the purple card, the Tradjenta is eliminated via the feces. That's a DPP-4 inhibitor. So if they do have kidney problems, Tradjenta is your safest bet. That one doesn't rely on renal elimination. The side effects are rare, like what the ADA guideline said, but if people do complain, they complain of headache. For all of these medications, the DPP-4 and the GLP-1s will be going over. We have to watch out for pancreatitis. And here's the cost. So if you're cash pay, it's not cheap. It's going to be expensive. Most insurance companies cover it, but it might be a big deductible. So we're cautious. We make sure that the patient's insurance can accommodate this if this is the best medication for them. That's really important. So DPP-4 inhibitors, how do they rate? Do they cause hypoglycemia? Nope. Do they cause weight gain? Nope. Are they affordable? Nope. They lower cardiovascular risk? Nope. Can most people tolerate? Yes. So what did you all give these out of 5? Yeah, I'm about a 3. I would say I'm a 3 because they're expensive and they don't lower blood sugars dramatically. You know, you get about a 0.5 to a 1 drop in A1C. But I do like them because they're really easy to take and they don't cause hypoglycemia or weight gain. So I'm going to give them a 3, and when they become generic, that number is going to go up. I'm going to give them a 5 when they become affordable and Walmart offers them for, you know, a 3-month supply for $10. I'll get a 5. Okay, let's do another poll question. Patient is on metformin and sulfonylurea. Her A1C is 8.4. Patient has been trying to lose weight with limited success. Which of the following medications would be indicated to improve her blood glucose without increasing her body weight? Would it be A, basal insulin, B, GLP-1 agonists, C, the meglitinides, or D, bolus insulin? So let's launch this poll. Okay, 88% of you have voted. So what I would suggest to you, if you're not sure, get rid of wrong answers first. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. Okay, so this is a really common problem for our patients, and they come in looking like this gal is here. They're just distressed, they're distraught, and they're just like, I'm trying everything and I can't lose weight. So which of the following would improve her blood sugar without increasing her weight? Nobody chose basal insulin, you're absolutely right. 94% of you chose GLP-1 agonist. That's absolutely the right answer. 6% of you chose meglitinides. Now meglitinides will increase body weight, not that much, but they will increase it. So that would not be a good medication to add on. They're a secretagogue. They tell the pancreas to make more insulin. Anytime you make more insulin, you increase body weight. So if you chose C, that's okay. It just means you want to take a look at those pocket cards and you want to do some flashcards for yourself to get ready. But 94% of you got that right. So good job, you guys. And the other thing I do want to say is if you're not familiar with medications, you want to figure out what's wrong. So we know insulin causes weight gain. Magliclinides cause weight gain. So what's left? GLP-1 agonist. So sometimes you're going to have to figure out the right answer on a basis of elimination. So when the goal is to avoid weight gain, these meds are weight neutral. Metformin is weight neutral, the DPP-4 inhibitors, and the AGI known as acarbose. These meds are associated with weight loss, and I wrote them down for you, the GLP-1 agonists, the SGLT2 inhibitors, and Semlin. So this is, wow, such important information when we work with our patients who come in, who are just struggling with their weight and they need some support and coaching from us. We can direct them toward medications that are going to support weight loss, but also, as you know, we have to consider insurance. So let's take a little look at the medications known as the incretin mimetics or the gut hormone imitators or the GLP-1 agonists. How do they work? Let's take a look. So GLP-1, that just stands for glucagon-like peptide. So whenever I say the word gut hormone or incretins, that's just a way of talking about these gut hormones known as GLP-1. There's another gut hormone, GIP, but mostly we talk about this one. So this GLP-1 is released from the L cells of your intestine. It tells your pancreas to make more insulin. That's what it does. So these gut hormones released from the L cells of your intestine stimulate your pancreas to make insulin. It says increase beta cell response. And then they tell the alpha cells of your pancreas not to make glucagon because you're in a fed state. It tells your liver then, liver, don't release sugar. We're fed. Don't worry about it. It tells your stomach, don't release the content so quickly. So it slows gastric emptying. And then it tells your brain, hey, you're full, stop eating. So this gut hormone is so important because it does all of these things. It tells your pancreas to release insulin. It tells your liver not to release its glycogen stores. It tells your pancreas don't release any glucagon. We're in a fed state, and it says you're full, stop eating. People with type 2 diabetes make 50% less of this hormone. And so if you don't make this hormone, you can see your liver is pumping out sugar right around the time you're eating because it doesn't get the message to stop. And if you don't make enough of this hormone, you may not get a sensation that, hey, you're full, stop eating. And so if you don't make enough of this hormone, the GLP-1, the scientists have figured out a way to replace it. So now you can replace it through an injection. But I want to point out something else is that GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide, this hormone, is degraded by DPP-4 within minutes. We just talked about DPP-4s. So DPP-4 is an enzyme that breaks down our gut hormone. And so to have more gut hormone available, what the DPP-4 inhibitors do is block this enzyme from working. That's what Januvia and Onglyza and Tradjenta and Nucina do. They stop the enzyme, or they slow it down from breaking down what we do make as far as gut hormones. So there's two ways to elevate your gut hormones. You can take a DPP-4 inhibitor, or you can take a synthetic version of the gut hormone. So let's talk about that. The reason I have a picture of a lizard here, maybe it's a baby Gila monster, I'm not sure. But they isolated this GLP-1, this gut hormone, from the saliva of the Gila monster. And the Gila monster only eats a few times a year, so they were very interested, the scientists, in seeing what's in the saliva. And in the saliva of the Gila monster, they found a protein that was very similar to our own gut hormone. And so they isolated that, and they replicated it in the lab. And they did animal trials, and they did human trials, and they found that by giving this synthetic gut hormone, blood sugars went down and patients lost weight. Hey, when we're thinking about body weight, a majority of type 2 patients with diabetes are overweight or obese. We want to intensify lifestyle, start metformin, and we do want to consider GLP-1 receptor agonists, which I'll go over. Bariatric surgery is an option, And we want to just make sure for our lean patients, maybe they really do have that LADA, just evaluate that. Let's do a poll question. Alice injects exenatide XR Bydureon once a week. Which of the following should she report immediately? Bump at the injection site, nausea, C, weight loss, or D, sudden abdominal pain? What do you think she should report immediately? Okay, you guys. Good job. I like how hard you're studying. I can tell you all are studying a lot and getting ready for this exam. 100% of you voted and 100% of you got this right. You didn't even go for my juicy answer, bump at injection site. Sudden abdominal pain is what you all went for, which is the right answer. And the reason is all of these medications, the GLP-1 agonists and the DPP-4 inhibitors, have pancreatitis as a potential side effect. So great job. I just want to go over the different incretin mimetics that are available. When I use the word incretin mimetics, it's the same thing as a GLP-1 agonist. So when you look at all the algorithms on the ADA and ACE, they call it GLP-1RA. That's the wording they use. That stands for glucagon-like peptide receptor agonist. I call them incretin mimetics. It's the same thing. So you'll see, like in scientific language or in medications, they'll start with a certain descriptor, and over time they move to different descriptors. So GLP-1RA is easy to write in shorthand, so maybe that's why they use it in their definitions, you know, in their algorithms. The first one that came out as far as incretin mimetics or GLP-1 receptor agonists was exenatide, and it was twice a day before breakfast and dinner. And really, patients had great results. They were losing weight. Blood sugars were coming down. But it was a twice-a-day injection, so it's a little bit of a hassle. But look what it does. The action of all of these medications, the GLP-1 agonists or incretin mimetics, insulin release increased in response to meal, slows gastric emptying, causes satiety. Oh, wow. In red, I have here, protects beta cells. The ADA standards do talk about these medications in context of maybe they do help protect beta cells in the long term. And the better, you know, the more reserve of beta cells you have with type 2 diabetes, the better the outcomes are. So that's why you'll see in the algorithms are really pushing to start GLP-1s earlier because of that beta cell protective effects. And that's true in the ACE guidelines too. They're way up there at the top. They drop A1C by 0.7%, weight by 3 pounds, indicated for our type 2s only in mono or combination therapy. Some patients are taking a version of this that have type 1, the Victoza, and it's just experimental, but I think we're going to be seeing that opening up a little bit more in the future. Now, Byetta also has come out with the once-a-week injection called Bydureon. And so this is their new pen. When they first came out with Bydureon, it was a powder and a fluid. You had to mix it together. But this pen has it all contained in one device. And so this is their, look how short that needle is, so tiny. This is a once a week Bydureon. Decreases A1C by 1.6%, weight by 6 pounds. So just, you would think, well, once a week is not going to work as well. Well, actually, it works a little bit better than the twice-a-day injection. Not indicated for patients with a history of medullary thyroid tumor and pancreatitis warning. So the long-acting versions of this all have these two warnings. Medullary thyroid tumor, if you have any history of that or runs in the family, avoid this, or pancreatitis. We need to let somebody know for having any signs of pancreatitis. Here's another once-a-week incretin mimetic, or GLP-1 agonist, known as albiglutide Tanzium. You start off with a lower dose and work up to the 50 milligrams. Again, lowers A1C by 1 percentage point, weight by about 2 pounds. Everybody's different. It's a pen injector. There's a dry powder and water. You have to twist it to mix it and reconstitute it. But once you do that, very easy to inject. And again, the same caution. Medullary thyroid tumor and pancreatitis. Here's my favorite one, Trulicity. Once a week dosing, and it decreases A1C, very similar. It's a premixed pen injector with retracting needle. Really great device for those with needle phobias. So easy to use, really user-friendly for patient, and the needle retracts. Wow, terrific. So, and again, the same precautions. I just want to mention as I'm going through these that I have no stock in any medication and I receive no funding from any pharmaceutical. I do not receive funding from any pharmaceutical company. So all of my content is non-biased. It's just based on reading the scientific literature and the package inserts and just like what you would do, just reading things. I don't even actually visit with pharmaceutical reps because I want to be as non-biased as possible. So that's really important to me as far as presenting this information to you in a real straightforward way. So here's Victoza. This is the once a day injector. It's a GLP-1 analog. You work gradually up based on GI side effects. The reason I'm bringing this up is because, as I mentioned, it was used in a small trial with type 1s who were still on, they took their insulin plus Victoza on top of it, and they had some really good results. So maybe they'll continue that study on. But the thing I really want to mention about it is that liraglutide, which is Victoza, was approved for weight loss, but they named it something different. So it's the same medication, liraglutide, but they repackaged it and called it Saxenda. Saxenda has this, and Victoza have the same active ingredient, but at different doses. The Saxenda is a higher 3 milligram dose, Victoza 1.8. So it is a treatment for those with chronic weight management needs, and in addition to reduce caloric intake and physical activity. And Saxenda is approved for those adults with a BMI of 30 or greater or 27 or greater with other risk factors for heart disease. Wow. So I don't think this will be on the exam, but patients might ask you about this. They may say, wow, I have diabetes and my doctor put me on Saxenda. And it is approved FDA for weight loss, but we know the other benefit is going to be lowering of blood sugars. But there's two different formulations. And this just tells me that these medications, the GLP-1s, are really great at helping patients with that weight reduction, which is such a big deal for our patients. For all the GLP-1 agonists and the DPP-4s, there is that pancreatitis warning. So make sure any patient on these drugs to report abdominal pain right away. They've been following these medications for a long time, and they seem pretty safe. So I'm not, you know, I'm still telling my patients about it, but I'm not as worried as I was because it seems that as we gather more data and information, it's not that the risk is not strong. You know what? I just want to say something. People with diabetes are more likely to get pancreatitis and pancreatic cancers just from the fact of having diabetes. There is a relationship there. So we're trying to sort out, is this incretin mimetic or GLP-1 agonist making it worse? Or are we just a casual finding? And so it looks like right now these incretin mimetics do not increase risk dramatically for pancreatitis. It's not a causal relationship. Okay. Incretin mimetics, do they cause hypoglycemia? No. Do they cause weight gain? No, they cause weight loss. Are they affordable? Absolutely not. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? Nope. Can most people tolerate? Yeah, if people want to take an injection, if they're okay with injections, it seems pretty tolerable. There is some nausea and GI discomfort associated with it, but a lot of people are willing to put up with the nausea to lose weight. Isn't that interesting? So even though they're nauseated, they might have some GI discomfort, they're willing to manage that and to use that. So somebody was asking me how many injections per pen. It's just one. So since these medications, you just give it once a week, you use that pen one time and then you toss. So if you got a prescription, you would get four pens for the month. Okay, Oh, maybe you're asking about the Victoza. I'm not, or the Saxenda. I'm going to check into that. I'm not sure how they do that. That's a great question. All right. So, what questions? We have a 69-year-old male. We're going on to a new topic now. BMI of 28 on metformin, 1,000 milligrams twice a day, and exenatide, 10 milligrams. I'm sorry, 10 micrograms before breakfast and dinner. Here's his creatinine, and is 1.2, his A1C is 8.1. Patient is overweight with an 11-year history of diabetes. So what questions do we want to ask him? Well, we're wondering what are his blood sugars running during the day, right? I mean, certainly he's on metformin, he's on exenatide, which is Byetta. They're both at their max dose. And so we don't have much more room. We can't increase these medications at all. We just have to work with, we have to add something different is my main question. And so his A1C is elevated even though he's on max dose of these meds. So my question is, he's overweight. We've got to add another medication. What medication would you consider? He's on a GLP-1, he's on metformin. What could be our next choice for him? So let me go ahead and move on to this poll question and we'll answer that. For patients on SGLT2 inhibitors, a potential side effect is A, balanitis, B, hypertension, C, kidney tenderness, or D, increased uric acid. Let me go ahead and launch that poll. Catherine Terry wants to know, is insurance Medicare covering for Saxenda and obesity? It would really depend on the insurance company. I'm not sure, it depends on your Medicare coverage and your secondary. So I don't know. It's pretty new out there, so I don't really have an answer for if it's being covered or not. And Carrie Patterson tells us Victoza has 10 doses of 1.8 milligrams in each pen. Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate that. Okay, so now we are back to our poll question. For patients on SGLT2 inhibitors, the potential side effect is which of the following? I'm going to close this in a few seconds. This question might be in the category of maybe you're not familiar with one of the terms, but the other ones seem wrong. Okay. I'm going to close this poll so we can keep going and share it with you. Okay, this was an interesting one. So I did purposefully, and I'm apologizing to all of you, but I'm trying to present you with the types of situations you're going to encounter on the exam. So that's why I'm doing these questions the way I do. So I put a term in here that's pretty obscure. Most of you probably haven't heard of it. Maybe, half of you looks like have heard of it. But balanitis is an infection of the penis. And so these SGLT2 inhibitors, since they're glucuretics, do cause increased release of glucose from the urine. So women get more infections, bladder infections, and vulvular infections, and men get more infections of the penis. So I just want, that's important to know because patients need to know that to be on the lookout for it and do better hygiene, especially after they go to the bathroom. But the thing I want to say about test taking is you may not know this term, but let's go to the other ones. Do SGLT2 inhibitors cause hypertension? No, nobody chose that. They actually cause hypotension. Do they cause kidney tenderness? No, they don't. I mean, they do increase the release of glucose from the urine, but they're not going to make your kidneys more tender. So we just need to be familiar with what these medications do and the side effects. So they increase uric acid. No, they don't. And so you want to be familiar with SGLT2 inhibitors or glucuretics. They tell the kidneys to release more sugar. If you release more sugar from the kidneys, you're more likely to get infections. That's the main issue here. So A is the right answer, and 57% of you got that right. So good job, everybody. And the way I heard about balanitis is I was at a conference, and they were talking about SGLT2 inhibitors and the side effects, and they kept saying this word, balanitis. I'm like, what is this word? So, of course, I Googled it, and then I saw what it meant. So it's out there. You'll hear it mentioned in presentations, and you'll see it in papers. So I thought, you know, but it's still pretty obscure, but I thought I could throw it in there as an example of get rid of all the wrong answers and the right ones should bubble up. Okay, I'm going to move on. So SGLT2 inhibitors are glucuretics. They decrease the renal reabsorption in the proximal tubule of the kidneys. So they're inhibiting the reuptake of glucose in the kidneys' tubules. You know what? When you have diabetes, normally your renal threshold is 1. I'm sorry. Without diabetes, your renal threshold is 180. So normally you spill glucose when your blood sugars exceed 180. However, when you have diabetes, your renal threshold is upregulated to 210. So you don't spill glucose till your blood sugars are above 210. This medication kind of resets your renal threshold back down to 180, or this class of medications. They're glucuretics. They're going to let your kidneys, they tell your kidneys, it's okay, release the sugar. They support your kidneys in releasing the sugar and getting that renal threshold back to 180. Currently, we have three of them, Invokana, Farxiga, Jardiance, and each of them you take once daily, which is really nice for our patients. But we do have to consider kidney function, because these medications, when patients first start on them, do slightly bump down the GFR. The GFR temporarily lowers a little bit. So we have to have good kidney reserve for patients on these. So you can see for each of these, when the GFR is less than 60, we either don't use or we go to a lower dose. But Invokana, I don't know why my computer does that, sorry. Invokana actually, you know, you can still use it with a GFR less than 60 compared to these other ones. So just something we consider. We're going to monitor, you know, kidney function, GFR, creatinine for any patient on these medications. We're going to make sure they're keeping hydrated. And Farxiga has a special message that we need to pay attention to. Don't use if patient has bladder cancer. So it seemed that in some of the studies, Farxiga did seem to be associated with an increased risk of bladder cancer. So we want to just monitor or make sure anybody with a history of bladder cancer, don't use that, and please report any blood in the urine. So kidney function is a big deal for this medication. Efficacy, look at this, weight loss of 1 to 3 pounds reduces A1C 0.7 to 1.5. Wow, that's pretty amazing. That's a big drop. So I mentioned may temporarily lower GFR. We want to monitor blood pressure, potassium, and renal function. As this, all the water is spilled out, electrolytes are going to go out with that, as well as glucose. So the side effects include hypotension, UTI, increased urination, genital yeast infections, and other benefits. Well, it might actually reverse glucose toxicity by increasing GLUT4 transport in the muscle. That's pretty cool, because remember we said type 2 diabetes, one of the main defects may be insulin resistance of the muscle. So if this medication can help with that, that would be terrific. And maybe it increases liver sensitivity to insulin and decreases gluconeogenesis. But the main impact is here on the kidneys. So how would we rate our SGLT2 inhibitors? Do they cause hypoglycemia? Nope. Do they cause weight gain? Nope. Are they affordable? Nope. They lower cardiovascular risk? Nope. Can most people tolerate? I said, yeah. I have a lot of patients are taking this, and actually, they really enjoy it. They do have to go to the bathroom more, but they seem like it's worth it, because not only are they seeing their blood sugars come down, but also their body weight. So just really good hygiene for this medication, keeping hydrated and monitoring their GFR and creatinine. I just like to wrap up with a few other medications that we're seeing less in our clinical practice. The insulin sensitizers, Avandia and Actos, decrease insulin resistance by making muscle and adipose cells more sensitive. They decrease free fatty acids. If you remember, type 2 is a situation where we have a lot of inflammation, elevated triglycerides, elevated free fatty acids. So these medications actually help decrease free fatty acids and inflammation. They have a unique functionality in that way, but they ran into so many problems. Pioglitazone, also known as Actos, bladder cancer warning. So many of the European countries have stopped allowing Actos to be prescribed. We're still prescribing it in America, but with a bladder cancer warning. So anyone with a history of bladder cancer or bleeding on your nation needs to report that immediately. Actos, the max dose, 45 milligrams daily. It takes about 6 weeks for these medications to work. So once you get them on, it takes 6 weeks to reach max efficacy. And then once you stop them, it takes about 6 weeks to get out of the bloodstream completely. The other one, Avandia, as you recall, it was restricted. No one could be started on it new because of they thought it increased the risk for heart attack. Guess what? FDA looked at all the studies again and relaxed the restriction. So now there is no restriction. Avandia is available, but you can see the damage has been done. Nobody's on Avandia anymore. So I feel kind of bad for this medication because it does offer this benefit. But the main problem why people don't use these medications much is a fluid retention. And you'll see if patients don't respond well to these, they come into your office after 6 weeks of being on this medication and their ankles are completely swollen. That's fluid retention from using these medications. So anybody started new on these meds, I look at their ankles. And if they have CHF, this is not an indicated medication. And also it does cause more increases the risk of peripheral bone fractures. So for our elderly who are unstable, it is not a good choice for them. It is generic, but even though it's generic, it still costs $100 a month cash pay. So do TZDs cause hypoglycemia? Nope. They cause weight gain? Yep. And I say any weight gain over 5 pounds, report to your provider immediately because that means fluid weight gain. It could really put your heart at risk. It's generic, but it's not that affordable. Lower cardiovascular risk, I put question marks here because it does lower free fatty acids, but it wasn't FDA approved for that. Can most people tolerate? Well, you have to watch for CHF. So for the TZDs, what do I give it? I'm giving them a 2 because they're not that cheap and the risk of fluid retention. Let's wrap up on our last class of medications, the glucosidase inhibitors, known as acarbose. We don't really see Miglitol, but it's available. Nobody's ever on it that I've ever seen in my life. But these medications do slow the absorption of carbohydrate and do result in postprandial drops in blood sugar. Minimal systemic absorption, so they're safe for our patients to use. What happens, the alpha-glucosidase inhibitor, so whenever you see word ending with ACE, we know that's an enzyme. So this enzyme helps break down carbohydrates. It inhibits this enzyme that breaks down starches in the small intestine. So we take these medications with the first bite of meals, but what happens is, since it slows absorption of the carbohydrate, the carbohydrates are absorbed more through a process known as fermentation. And fermentation causes a lot of gas. So this is not a good drug for people with inflammatory bowel disease. And a really important point for the test, since it slows the absorption of carbohydrate to later in the intestine, if they're on this medication, acarbose, with a sulfonylurea or insulin, and they get low blood sugar, they need to treat with glucose tabs or milk. That's very important to know. Other starches are blocked by medication. So don't use orange juice. It's going to be delayed in absorption. You need to use glucose tabs or milk to get through. So does acarbose cause hypoglycemia? No, not by itself. Weight gain? Nope. Affordable? Yeah, it's generic. It's more affordable. Lower cardiovascular risk? There was one study that indicated it did. And I'm going to look that up to double check for all of you. Can most people tolerate it? Well, not really, because a lot of people have such bad gas with it. So it's not used that much. Let's wrap up on one more poll question. George is type 2. He's losing weight and thirsty with an A1C of 10.3%. Using ACE guidelines, what is the appropriate action? Would we A, evaluate lifestyle changes for 3 months? B, start insulin therapy? C, start metformin immediately? Or D, start metformin plus another agent? According to the ACE guidelines, what would you do? I'm going to launch this poll. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay, let me go ahead and close this poll since we're getting close to wrapping up. Okay, this is really such a great learning opportunity. If you got this wrong, it's okay. Just take a look at the ACE guidelines. The ACE guidelines say if the A1C is above 9 and the patient is symptomatic, we need to start insulin therapy. So this is good to know because he is symptomatic, he's losing weight, he's thirsty, his A1C is elevated. So I did mention that we always want to look at lifestyle therapy, but this says evaluate lifestyle changes for 3 months. No, you can't wait that long. And when the A1C is this high, you have to take immediate action. So A is the wrong answer. B is the right answer, start insulin. D, start metformin plus another agent. It does say to start dual therapy if their A1C is above 9, but if they have symptoms, it says to start insulin. So if you chose a different answer than B, I would just take a look at the algorithm and become more familiar with it. Great job, everybody. So here's some critical points. Individualized glycemic targets and blood glucose lowering. Diet, exercise, and education are the foundation. Metformin is the optimal first-line drug. That's ADA and ACE. After metformin, we don't have great data. Metformin's been out a long time, so combination therapy is reasonable. Ultimately, many people with type 2 will require insulin therapy, and all treatment decisions should be made in conjunction with the patient, focused on preferences, needs, and values. And cardiovascular reduction is a major focus of therapy. And in your handout, this is from the ACE guidelines. You might want to look at the new ones I posted on your resource page today. But this has a real nice description of the profiles of the anti-diabetic medications, looking at the class on top and the side effects on the left. Here's some self-study questions for you to take a look at. And I do want to say that our next boot camp is Boot Camp 6, April 23rd, Nutrition and Exercise. That's this week. And then next week, Boot Camp 7, April 27th on Monday, we're just going to be going over test-taking questions. So I'll just give you a bunch of questions, and we'll go through them together and figure out what is the right answer. I did add Boot Camp 8 on May 7th, Behavior Change and Coping. So that's available for free. We'll be adding that to your student center, so you can have that up and running. I hope it's before you all are taking the exam, as early as I could get it in. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you for your feedback and taking the poll questions. And I'm going to sign off, but as always, I'm still going to be available offline. I might go off for a second, so stick with me. Thank you. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.